Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the announcement this week by the Director of National Intelligence and the Head of Homeland Security naming Russia as the culprit in the hacking of our election that appears designed to hurt Hillary Clinton and help Donald Trump, and pointing their finger at the Kremlin, saying, quote, that only Russia's senior-most officials could have authorized these activities. Patrick Tucker, the technology editor at Defense One and author of The Naked Future, What Happens in a World That Anticipates Your Every Move, joins us to assess why Putin would be so brazen in leaving his fingerprints on this apparently extensive and coordinated cyber espionage assault. And given the political misfortune of Donald Trump at the moment, what kind of judgment does the Russian leader have in thinking he could put his man in the White House? Then we will speak with Elaine Pagels, a professor of religion at Princeton University and author of Beyond Belief and Revelations, Vision, Prophecy, and Politics in the Book of Revelation. She joins us to discuss the extent to which evangelicals will stick with Trump in spite of the recent revelations about his lewd attitude to women and whether right-wing politics are more important to the religious right than moral values. We'll also discuss the sudden shock and indignation that Republican supporters of Trump are now exhibiting when they surely knew all along who Trump is and how he behaves. Then finally, we'll examine what might be in store for Hillary Clinton in tonight's debate, given the not-so-veiled threats coming from Donald Trump, who will likely bring up Bill Clinton's sexual history and blame Hillary Clinton for alleged harassment of women her husband had affairs with. Joining us is Adele Stan, a journalist based in Washington, D.C., who is the Washington editor of Alternet and writes a weekly column at the American Prospect, where she has an article decoding Mike Pence's misogyny, as well as an article at alternet.org. Will the presidential debate add fuel to the Trumpster fire? And joining us now is Patrick Tucker, the technology editor for Defense One and author of The Naked Future, What Happens in a World That Anticipates Your Every Move. Welcome to Background Briefing, Patrick Tucker.
Thank you for having me.
And Patrick, what do you make of the head of National Intelligence, Director of National Intelligence, General Clapper, along with the head of Homeland Security, announced this week saying that there was high confidence that Russia was involved in the hacking that seems to be largely targeted at Hillary Clinton, and that this would not have happened without authorization at the highest levels. My understanding of cyber espionage is that you sneak in, you loiter as long as you can, you get what you want, and you sneak out without leaving any fingerprints. So why would, if Putin is doing this, why would he be so brazen?
Well, there's really two sides to that question. The first is, how much evidence is there that this hacking of first the DNC and also the DCC is related to state-sponsored Russian activity? There's plenty of evidence for that going back to the spring, all of it very well documented by first the cybersecurity community and now officially endorsed, if you will, by the United States intelligence community and the Department of Homeland Security. And then there's the second question of why the Kremlin and Putin in particular would be doing that. The first one, we have lots of evidence to answer. The second one, we can really only speculate. But the story of this goes back to April when the DNC called in a cybersecurity company called CrowdStrike, which found two different actors on DNC servers. One had been there for a year, quietly stealing information. That's APT28. Another had been there much more recently, back in April, the APT29, as named by a different cybersecurity company called FireEye. But these two groups are well known to the cybersecurity community. A lot of different researchers have had different experiences with them. CrowdStrike calls them Fancy Bear and Cozy Bear. They're much more sort of like attractive and memorable names. But they're responsible also for an intrusion into the Joint Chiefs of Staff and also into the State Department. So the difference is that, you know, these guys aren't terribly exotic to operations. People have known them for a long time. The difference is that they operationalized stolen information, which is the sort of thing that in espionage, it's very uncommon to see that happen. For instance, you know, the OPM hack, which now, you know, most people understand fully to be traced back to China. China hasn't done anything with all this information that they've stolen yet. The United States potentially uses different access tools to steal information on different governments and things like this. But the difference was that these two groups used WikiLeaks to publish information that they thought was going to be damaging to the DNC. It certainly was. Debbie Wasserman Schultz was forced to resign. And that's the big difference, is the use of WikiLeaks almost in a weaponized fashion to actually undermine the United States election. That got a lot of people talking about this, and that's where this entire thing sort of comes from. But all the evidence actually linking these two groups to that disclosure on WikiLeaks, it's very well documented and endorsed first by FireEye, which endorsed CrowdStrike's initial findings, and then Mandiant, and then ThreatConnect. So it's really been building. This final announcement on Friday by the intelligence community simply endorses a ton of work that's already gone into this. But the question of why the Kremlin would be doing this, there's a lot of different theories as to why they might have been doing this. One is that this was a kind of experimental operation that went out of control, and now these groups are working together in a much more concerted way. But in the beginning, they were really just sort of looking to see what they could do, what would happen if they released this information to WikiLeaks. Another is that obviously Donald Trump would be a more attractive candidate for the Kremlin, especially given things that he said about the irrelevance of NATO and to much less press coverage. The potential of recognizing Crimea as part of Russia, which would effectively remove any pressure for continuance of sanctions against different figures of Russian import in Putin's cabinet. So, and then there's a third that says that, hey, maybe they were actually just trying to show the West that this sort of capability is something that they have, that they can get into different Democratic Republican parties, because they've also hacked the Republican Party and different figures within the Republican Party, that they can take information and that they're willing to actually operationalize it, they're willing to leak it to a third party, to embarrass party officials, that they're that brazen. And all they're trying to do, rather than pick one candidate over another, is show their ability to do this. It's capability telegraphing. It's the same thing that we do with larger weapon systems, but they're doing it with information. But in terms of why, we really have no option but to speculate.
And again, I'm speaking with Patrick Tucker, who's the technology editor for Defense One and author of The Naked Future, What Happens in a World That Anticipates Your Every Move. But it does seem, though, that if it started out as an ad hoc operation, it's very coordinated. And I've heard reports from Russian intelligence that there's some dissent within the security services, with the more seasoned veterans being quite worried about the blowback, and where the younger, more eager officers and operatives are, chafing at the bit. And there's apparently over $1 billion being thrown at this operation. But if you go back to all of the problems that Hillary Clinton's had throughout this the course of this election, you can't help noticing how it does appear to be well coordinated or extremely well targeted, because the first revelation from the hack of Sidney Blumenthal revealed the very existence of these servers that had caused us so much trouble. And that was first revealed in RT, which is Putin's Russian language, English language propaganda outlet, in March of 2013, where they said in the spirit of public service, they were releasing the information that she had this private server. So, and then right. And then the most recent one, of course, in this last data dump from WikiLeaks, is a hack into John Podesta, the head of her campaign, revealing the some of the damaging remarks that she made, and also the lectures she gave to Wall Street. So it's pretty hard for me not to see this as an intelligence operation rather than a bunch of sort of ad hoc group of anarchist hackers, weighing in.
Well, the evidence does suggest that it definitely was an intelligence and influence operation, and it fits in line with other Russian influence operations that have occurred in Eastern Europe. But that doesn't mean it was the best planned one. On the one hand, it's true, this slow drip, drip, drip of leaks, the operationalization of WikiLeaks and also DC leaks, and the slow cultivation of different friendly media outlets that they can push information to, that does look deliberate. It also looks perfectly well executed at the same time. Two different intelligence groups, the GRU and the FSB, both being on DNC service at the same time, CrowdStrike's conclusion was that they probably didn't know that the other one was on there. These two groups have a highly competitive relationship. It's not like intel groups and different agencies in the United States, which after 9/11 began to work better in an incredibly more coordinated fashion. These two groups don't actually like each other. So there's some evidence to suggest that they began working together only recently after this entire operation came out. There's some suggestion that they didn't expect to be caught, but there's also some suggestion that maybe they did. If you look at some of the metadata on the documents that were released through WikiLeaks, you actually find a signature for Iron Felix, the old FSB secret security director. And that seems either really intentional or a really dumb accident. It's hard to say. So there's a lot of evidence suggests that, exactly as you said, that this is an intentional intelligence operation. But there's also so many other clues that it seems almost impossible to believe they intended to be found. And this is the way I think often, you know, these sorts of operations work. You know, this group has also been linked to two other groups that don't get a lot of press. There was a proxy group called Cyber Briquette, which took in different pieces of information and tried to embarrass the Ukrainian government. And these two groups have also been linked to a fake group called the Cyber Caliphate, which was masquerading as an ISIS media arm. And their function is that they actually released a bunch of personal documents on U.S. service people. It's all stuff that was readily available online. It wasn't sort of like hacked into or anything. It was just good sort of Googling. But that suggests that this is part of an ongoing operation to see where the boundaries are, to kind of test what happens when you do what when. You know, this is an entirely new type of operation, entirely new as promulgated against the West. But this is how they've operated in parts of Eastern Europe for a long time. First, you see what operation you could, what information you can get. You see where you might release it. You see how you might release it. And it's part of a learning process. So they've been learning in real time about what's working and what doesn't in this election, as they have in previous Eastern European elections that they've tried to influence.
Well, certainly going back to the Cold War, there's no question that the GRU and the KGB were completely independent of each other. And for example, the Alger Hiss, who was always considered a controversial figure, the KGB, when their files were released, there was no evidence that he would ever spy, even though a lot of hay was made over it during the Cold War. But then it turned out he was run by the GRU. So, and the KGB didn't even know about him. So that's a point well taken. But what then is the role of Jacob Applebaum and Julian Assange of WikiLeaks? Are they what the KGB used to refer to as useful idiots, or are they actively on the payroll?
There's no evidence to suggest that that I've seen to suggest that Julian Assange has taken, for instance, money from the KGB. I think that the useful idiot, it is a term we can use because it does have a history. It's not just me making an insulting remark about Julian Assange, though I disagree with him on things. I think that theory probably holds a little bit more water. So, you know, back in June, after WikiLeaks released this dump, just a day before, they had actually very proudly, very enthusiastically retweeted something from a strange character named Guccifer 2.0. So this is a sort of a Twitter persona that claimed to be a lone actor who had hacked into the DNC. He maligned CrowdStrike's work, you know, naming Cozy Bear and Fancy Bear, said, "I did it independently." A little bit of investigation and research into Guccifer 2.0 revealed that based on where he was tweeting from, when he was tweeting, and how even his facility with the Romanian language, because he claimed to be Romanian, all suggested that he was actually just a front for different, you know, for the FSB, for the GRU, for the entire Russian-based operation. So WikiLeaks proudly retweeted him as the potential source for this new document dump. And I asked them the next, after this information, you know, was released back in June, the first big dump, if they had undertaken any steps to make sure that Guccifer 2.0 was not a Russian state-backed actor. And they refused to answer the question, yes or no. They did respond, saying that they had received the question, but they refused to say, yes, we did, in fact, check to make sure this isn't a state-backed actor, or no, we didn't. And that plausible deniability is really key to the way WikiLeaks is supposed to work. It's supposed to be this kind of anonymous publishing platform, and that's what lent it to this operation. So you just give your information, the stolen information that you have to WikiLeaks. Who you are is not supposed to matter. They have a system for anonymizing these donations. And yet at the same time, they also have a lot of clues about where this particular data dump came from. And I think they clearly believe that it probably is at this point from Russian state-backed actors from these two groups. But they have just enough plausible deniability to continue their activities, avoid any accountability for becoming a de facto arm of Russian intelligence operation. And I think that really calls into question their continued integrity. I mean, whether or not we're going to view them as a news source with integrity if they know they're being used this way, and yet they persist in this activity.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, given the misfortunes that Donald Trump has at the moment, it would seem that if Putin was betting on putting their man in the White House, that's not working out so well. That's one question. But in general, is there just a broader possibility that what Putin is saying, because it does seem that he's being brazen and doesn't mind this being attributed to him, is that, like, you know, this is payback for his perception that the U.S. has meddled in their elections and created the colored revolutions, etc. He's very angry at Hillary Clinton for blaming him for the who he blamed for the demonstrations against him when he took power again in 2011. So could it just be that they're trying to sow confusion, and that the real audience for Putin is the domestic audience, and he's saying to the Russian people, okay, I may have taken your democracy away, but look at these other hypocrites in the West. They have totally screwed up democracy as well.
Right. That is a theory that I think also makes a ton of sense, that the ultimate goal may or may not be to get Trump elected. That might be a side benefit. It might not even be an objective, but to create uncertainty and undermine the very idea of democracy, of Western United States democracy, and to undermine the, perhaps faith in the American people that their own democratic system can work, but certainly to reveal to the Russian population this democracy that acts as an aggressor towards us is flawed from beginning to end and is incredibly fragile, and we've just revealed all of that. I think that theory also holds a lot of water, that he's playing almost entirely to domestic audience to show how very tender this superpower is. And, this is something that we're going to overcome, too, though. This is, I think you're absolutely right, that there's, while this has been, I think, a very, given the cost of it, a very successful operation, because it didn't really cost them anything yet. There might be additional sanctions, but that's impossible to tell yet. This, in terms of actually achieving an effect, they did so for virtually nothing. But regardless of where this ultimately leads, we've begun to get a sense that, this sort of influence operation is possible, that it occurred very cheaply, and we're going to continue to keep an eye on it as free media so that we can continue to report on it, and the truth will just come out.
Well, Patrick Tucker, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Patrick Tucker, who's the technology editor for Defense One and author of The Naked Future, What Happens in a World That Anticipates Your Every Move. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back looking into the extent to which evangelicals will stick with Donald Trump in spite of the recent revelations about his lewd attitude to women. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Elaine Pagels, who's a professor of religion at Princeton University and the author of many books, including The Gnostic Gospels, Reading Judas, and the New York Times bestseller Beyond Belief. She's the author of Revelations, Vision, Prophecy, and Politics in the Book of Revelation. Welcome to Background Briefing, Elaine Pagels.
Thank you very much.
And what do you make of this this dilemma, I guess, that the Republicans and their evangelical wing are having now, the extent to which evangelicals will stick with Trump in spite of his recent revelations about his lewd attitude to women, or whether right-wing politics are more important to the religious right than moral values? It seems to be a fairly stark situation for them in terms of their very credibility.
Well, it would seem like that, and it does rather to me. But look at the things they've already overlooked. The insult to the Khan family, military family, as you know. Insults to people of Hispanic background, to Muslims, to black people. I mean, he's already insulted about everybody you can think of. And this is kind of, you know, just the latest chapter in a long barrage of insulting remarks about all kinds of people. I mean, I'm amazed that anyone would stick with him through all that. But I know that there are people, for example, my colleague Robert George on the Princeton faculty, he is a Catholic conservative who was partly involved in drafting the Defense of Marriage Act. And I think Robbie cares far more about prohibition of abortion, about the next Supreme Court judge, about issues of conservative politics and tax policy than he does about the personal character of Donald Trump. And apparently that's what one could infer from many evangelicals who no doubt, wouldn't you think they'd be shocked by this behavior or just at least turned off by it?
Well, it does seem sort of rather selective to suggest that it's not important who sits in the White House. It's only important who sits on the Supreme Court. I'm not sure I understand that logic.
Well, the Supreme Court, as you know, can last for decades.
Sure.
And which majority it has will determine so much about the policy of this country. I mean, it determined, you know, the election of George Bush, for example.
Sure. No, I got that wrong. I meant to say I see the logic. The logic is pretty clear.
Yeah.
I just don't see the moral clarity.
Well, I don't see this as moral clarity either. I think they feel that the moral priorities are the lives of unborn children who would otherwise, die in abortions. And they also feel it's a moral issue for many to have the rights to bear arms in the way that they traditionally have without any diminution of those. The character of the man seems to be inconsequential, but I would have thought that would be obvious before now.
So what's your sense then of where this is heading? Is there going to be a drip, drip, drip? And we just got through talking about Russia's efforts to help elect Donald Trump and hurt yes. Hillary Clinton, which the intelligence community went public on this week. And it is pretty extraordinary to me, again, in this same context of this conversation about morality on the Republican side, how they could, their political fortunes in this election rest upon entirely relying upon the Russians to elect their man, which I find absolutely extraordinary, given the conservative right-wing nature of the of Republican politics and how they've always been the more hawkish party throughout the Cold War vis-a-vis Russia. But here they are as, in effect, allies of Putin. That in itself is extraordinary. So do you think that there'll be these drip, drip, drips on both sides, more news about Trump's lewd behavior with women and more of these leaks from WikiLeaks hurting Hillary? Is that the trajectory we're on?
Well, I think your guess on that sounds very accurate. It seems to me that, you know, people who are releasing the WikiLeaks are doing so quite deliberately at a pace which is designed to, you know, probably lead up to the worst revelations within the next few weeks, right? And probably the other side is also going to use some of those. It's quite stunning. You would think, though, that, I mean, I think about the teaching of Jesus as a teaching about loving your neighbor, caring for the sick, caring for the poor, you know, a kind of generosity socially and economically that is very much the heart of the sermons of Jesus. So I wonder what happened to those.
And again, I'm speaking with Elaine Pagels, who's a professor of religion at Princeton University and the author of many books, including the Gnostic Gospels, Reading Judas, and the New York Times bestseller Beyond Belief. She's the author of Revelations, Vision, Prophecy, and Politics in the book of Revelation. Well, it is a little bit hard to sort of... I'm reminded of that classic scene in the movie Casablanca, where the French chief of police says, "This, you mean there's gambling going on in this establishment? You mean Donald Trump is a misogynist? I mean, you know, hello." that's the part that this sort of sudden shock and indignation that's coming from so many Republican quarters, with about 15 senators now turning against him. All of the previous presidential, both presidents and presidential candidates on the Republican side, with the exception of Bob Dole, have all come out and repudiated Trump. It's a pretty extraordinary, Condoleezza Rice. It's an pretty extraordinary pantheon of Republican establishment figures. Some may argue they're coming to the table a little late, but nevertheless they are. So what's your sense of the weight of this moral argument going on within the Republican Party, who many of whom do wear their morality on their sleeve, most of all, of course, the vice presidential nominee, Mike Pence? He's brazenly religious.
Yes, I think there must be very many people in evangelical churches who feel deeply about moral issues. Fairness and respect for women and people and minorities and a kind of social fairness. But those seem to be secondary to the question of taxes, gun rights, which is about states' rights, of course, from their point of view, and the issues about abortion, and perhaps the concern about foreign people. I mean, it does seem, does it not, at least it looks to me, that what is driving much of this is the demographic shift, in which we see far more African-American, Hispanic voters of every kind of ethnicity participate. That must really trouble and upset people who feel that their rightful position as the rulers of this country is being displaced.
But I've never understood, you know, I guess it's the sort of vestiges of the Age of Enlightenment. You assume that if you have the best logical fact-based argument, therefore you win the argument. And, for example, in terms of these theological arguments over who Jesus was and what his teachings were about and what the Bible's really about, particularly the New Testament, you know, you can't help, as you mentioned earlier, coming to the conclusion that the Jesus in the Bible didn't hate homosexuals, didn't carry an assault rifle, didn't celebrate capital punishment, didn't go on television shaking down poor people for money, et cetera, et cetera. So why is it that the authenticity of the religious left, if there's such a thing, seems to be drowned out by the fervor of the religious right?
Well, I don't think it's entirely drowned out. I mean, even today in the Times, you see that there are Christians who are strenuously opposing that kind of political program. and they're doing so on the basis of equality and the basis of equal rights for everybody and social justice. What's interesting to me, and of course I confess I'm not, as you can tell, I'm not indifferent to this. I have rather strong political views on this. I mean, Hillary Clinton, it seems to me, her faults are dissected in public a great deal, as you know. But she is, as I read her, a rather small-town Methodist who has a lot of concern about social justice herself. And it would seem to me that that could be obvious as well, but it hasn't been mentioned much. What do you make of that?
Well, I suppose it's, you know, I think it's just a, it's a, it's a character judgment. I think people who wear their religion on their sleeve are almost disingenuous, or at least one should be a little suspicious of people who advertise something and they may not really meet the expectations of the way they present themselves. Whereas somebody that who is more modest. In other words, it's almost like you know, the Good Samaritan being anonymous, and it's as though, you know, does a person who gives money to a charitable cause, a good cause, want to have their name emblazoned on the building, or do they just want to give the money and hope that the money is well spent?
Well, it's interesting because, you know, religious views are, as you know, played often for political effect. I must say that one reason that I think differently about Hillary Clinton, without being uncritical supporter, I'm certainly a supporter. When she was in the White House second term, there were 25 women nominated as sort of working mothers who were being honored for being working mothers. This is quite a while ago. And she was one of them, I was one of them, and most of them were heads of foundations or heads of businesses or representatives or, you know, people of public importance. And she invited all those women to the White House. And what impressed me very much, because I think very few people would have thought of it, had I been in her situation, I probably would not have thought of it. She had at every table a waitress from Tennessee who was a working mother, a woman firefighter from Washington, D.C. In other words, women who were not high profile and who were not politically advantageous. But she was making a statement about the importance of people regardless of their social standing. And I actually thought that was quite impressive. Nothing was said. This was just what we saw.
So just in the last couple of minutes then, Elaine Pagels, there's no question that at least there's a great deal of expectation based upon what Donald Trump has threatened already that tonight's second debate, he will unload on Bill Clinton's sexual peccadilloes and blame Hillary Clinton for the alleged harassment of the women who her husband had affairs with. It's a strange kind of an approach. I don't understand why he thinks it would be effective, but maybe it would. I don't know. But what's your sense of how, given that this assault is likely, how Mrs. Clinton should handle it?
Well, it's a very good question. I mean, I really think, you know, people, Donald Trump says, you know, she stayed with him when he was having all these affairs, and that's true. On the other hand, had she divorced him, they would equally come at her for that. I mean, so I think she would have been, in effect, damned if she did or didn't. I mean, there's always something you can charge somebody with. I think she should just maintain the composure she did at the last debate and try to stay above the fray. Her husband's behavior is not her behavior. I don't know what else she can possibly do.
Well, just in closing though, I mean, one of the great ironies here is that the in terms of the red states versus the blue states and where the religious right has the most traction in the states like Mississippi and Alabama, etc., the divorce rate's actually higher than it is in these dens of iniquity in the blue states like California and New York.
Oh, really?
Oh, yes. It's a well-established fact. So it's a strange world out there in terms of hypocrisy. And this, I guess hypocrisy is the word of the moment.
it's interesting that the issue of gay rights seems quite muted. And that, you know, that was such a rallying cry in previous elections. And now it just seems to be a bygone issue. Very interesting, because when I look at my students at Princeton, say, or students or people their age anywhere, 18 to 25 or whatever, this is not an issue at all. So I guess it just doesn't work anymore. The issue of marital infidelity, it's very interesting, as you say, that the selective attention of people who, I guess they feel they have more to gain from Donald Trump's presidency. Certainly, I saw that some people whom I like and respect are voting for Trump, and I suspected the reason, although they would not discuss it, has to do with the awareness that if Clinton were elected, their taxes would go up. These are people of considerable wealth. And I think that financial factor is a very serious one for many people.
Well, the puzzling part is that the people who support him, that are working Americans and middle-class Americans, whose taxes will probably go up while the rich get even their taxes cut, why they support him, that's even more of a puzzlement. You understand why the rich support him. There's obviously a direct result there in terms of their increasing their wealth. I thank you for joining us. I appreciate your time, Elaine Pagels.
Well, thank you. Well, it's going to be an adventure to see what happens tonight.
It will. We're all anticipating with bated breath, and I thank you again for joining us.
All right. Thank you.
Bye-bye. And again, I've been speaking with Elaine Pagels, who's a professor of religion at Princeton University and the author of many books, including The Gnostic Gospels, Reading Judas, and the New York Times bestseller Beyond Belief. She's the author of Revelations, Vision, Prophecy, and Politics in the Book of Revelation. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into what might be in store for Hillary Clinton in tonight's debate.
Already gone. You can ram out life down in a little book.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Adele Stan, who's a Washington editor for Alternet and a weekly columnist for The American Prospect, where she has an article decoding Mike Pence's misogyny. And at alternet.org, she has an article with the presidential debate add fuel to the Trumpster fire. Welcome to Background Briefing, Adele Stan.
Great to be with you, Ian.
Well, thank you, Adele. And of course, decoding Mike Pence's misogyny, his misogyny is somewhat overshadowed and eclipsed by Donald Trump's misogyny displayed in the video from Access Hollywood. Apparently, there's a vault full of outtakes from The Apprentice that are even more incriminating, according to a producer on The Apprentice. But Mark Burnett, the reality TV mogul, is a evangelical along with his wife, Roma Downey, and they support Trump. So there's a lot of pressure on Burnett to open up his vaults. So we'll see what happens there. But in general, do you expect to see a drip, drip, drip of scandal all the way to November?
Well, I think it'll be more like a cascading path of landmines. You know, I think things will be exploding more than dripping. I mean, with the extraordinary defection of so many Republicans right now as they try to figure out how to hold on to Congress, you know, with Trump as their standard bearer, I think that any further revelations going forward, and I expect there to be more, whether Burnett opens his vault or not, as you say, I think they're going to, you know, continue to implicate not only Trump as a terrible, terrible misogynist, which I've been writing since the very beginning, that was the whole raison d'etre for his candidacy. But, you know, I think it also is an indictment of the Republican Party writ large.
You mean the extent to which they've been described by James Fellows as the Vichy Republicans? They know who this guy is,
But I think it's deeper than that. And I'm in the midst of writing an essay right now that really looks at how, you know, going back to the 1964 Barry Goldwater campaign, I mean, that the construction of the right wing of the Republican Party was always predicated on these kinds of hatreds and fears that we see reflected in Donald Trump, and that it was that right-wing takeover of the Republican Party, which became the Republican establishment, it set the stage for Trump. They may not have wanted, you know, a candidate who behaved like Trump, but they cultivated the ground for him.
So when Trump made a very non-apology initially, and then he was forced to do a video apology, which was quite defiant, and he segued from apologizing into saying that Bill Clinton has actually abused women and Hillary has bullied, attacked, shamed, and intimidated his victims. We will discuss this more in the coming days. And obviously, that means...
And see you at the debate, is what he said.
And finished up by seeing you at the debate, which is coming up in a few hours from now. So given that expectation, what is he talking about, though? I mean, I thought that Hillary Clinton was the victim of her husband's, you know, serial peccadilloes, rather than the idea that she attacked, shamed, and intimidated his victims. Is there any evidence of that?
Well, I mean, privately, she did say, I think that she did refer to Monica Lewinsky as a narcissistic Looney Tunes. There's that. More recently, she was asked about a more serious claim against Bill Clinton by Juanita Broderick, who says that she was raped by Bill Clinton. And Hillary Clinton was asked at a campaign event by a reporter whether or not, didn't she always say that women who claimed to have been raped should always be believed, and doesn't that extend to Juanita Broderick? And Clinton replied with a somewhat artful response, which was that women who claim to have been raped should be believed until evidence was produced, you know, showing that that wasn't true. And left it at that. Now, no evidence has surfaced refuting Juanita Broderick's claim, but as many rape victims do, you know, who do eventually speak up about what happened to them, and she didn't do so until many, many years after the fact. So there's no way to really verify her claims one way or the other. So it's just, you know, it's not an easy situation right there, and it's not a comfortable one for those of us who are feminists, for sure. To say that Hillary has shamed and bullied Clinton's, you know, Bill Clinton's alleged victims or his conquests, or, you know, I mean, it seems to, there are various sorts of allegations out there. That's, you know, I don't see that, but I may not, you know, I can't promise to have been aware of every single thing she ever said about a woman who made an allegation against her husband.
But in general, in the broadest sense, her husband was cheating on her. He lied and covered up because he was afraid of her. Eventually it became public and he was humiliated. She was humiliated. I believe she even contemplated divorce. I think, isn't there a fairly good case she can make if she's prepared to
you know, let the public in on what really happened there. I mean, I just can't see how you can make the case that somehow she's the villain here in this situation, which is apparently what Donald Trump is going to try and do tonight.
That is what Donald Trump is going to try to do. It's not going to win him any new voters. And, you know, it is well known that women do not respond well to attempts to try to taint Hillary Clinton with her husband's behavior. Women definitely don't like that. At this point, I don't see how Donald Trump is really playing to win anymore in terms of the presidential race. I don't see how he can. What he's going to try to do is hold on to those people who are already in his camp, in his corner, and figure to do something with that constituency after the race is over. He won't pull out, I don't think, because his ego simply would not allow that. But, you know, these people will be a very strong constituency for any enterprise he might enter into going forward, whether it's to build some sort of a movement, which is less likely than some sort of media enterprise in which he could collect some money, shake some people down. but I think that's the way it's going to go, Ian, and I do think he will make it as ugly as he possibly can.
And again, I'm speaking with Adele Stan, who's a Washington editor for Alternet and a weekly columnist for the American Prospect, where she has an article decoding Mike Pence's misogyny. And also at alternet.org, she has an article, Will the Presidential Debate Add Fuel to the Trumpster Fire? But I think the defiance that Trump has already said, you know, he's not quitting, may have something to do with his inner circle of David Bossie and the Breitbart guy, Bannon, who are very, real hardliners. I get the impression that Trump really, and in fact, he apparently had to buck up his spirits by going outside of the building, and there was a crowd probably organized by the advanced people, you know, shouting support for him, and that's the drug
right.
that he feeds off. I think he honestly believes, because of these rallies he's had, that there's a huge constituency of Americans out there that support him and believe in him and want this populist right-wing revolution to take place. And I think that they honestly believe that, and I think they think that they're the outsiders. Everybody else is an insider. He's already spinning this Republican establishment going after him and saying, well, they're all the establishment, and I'm the outsider, and they're all the insiders, and we're going to sweep them away. Are they operating on sort of the fumes of optimism?
Are they operating on planet Earth as we know it?
And delusion. Is it possible that there's a huge well of discontent out there that's going to catch everybody by surprise?
Well, I mean, right now it's really, you know, if you asked me that question 2 weeks ago, and I would have been much more concerned about that. And I do think that there is a bit constituency of malcontents, and there will be tremendous backlash to a Clinton win. And I do think that we don't know how the race will shake out because we don't really know who comprises the electorate that will turn up at the polls on November 8th. We just don't know who all those people are. Will the young people turn out? Will young people of color turn out? Will people of color turn out in the same kinds of numbers that they turned out for Barack Obama? Will there be a new constituency of voters who have not previously exercised their right to vote in the last few elections showing up for Trump? We don't know this. So, but at the present time, I do think that his chances of winning have really plummeted given these comments. And but that doesn't mean there isn't a huge number of people who are going to be profoundly disturbed by a Clinton win, exercise incredible backlash against it, have bought into the very phenomenon you're talking about. Big enthusiastic rallies mean that Trump must be on the path to victory, therefore any victory by the other side will have been stolen, misappropriated, however you want to characterize it. Plus, they've been primed with all sorts of conspiracy theories. So I think America is in for it either way. I really do.
But is it possible, though, that if Trump, the wreckage continues to pile on and more Republicans defect, and I think there's about 15 Republican senators now that have said they're not going to vote for him, and Condoleezza Rice certainly is a prominent Republican who stayed out of it until now, saying enough is enough. She, you know, this guy cannot be president. So if that drip continues, and also the press piles on, and maybe if Burnett opens his vaults and we see even worse behavior by Trump on video, apparently, you know, screaming at women and shaming them and bullying them, etc., on his The Apprentice. Then could this result in a situation where it may end up not being that great for Hillary Clinton, that the assumption will be that she's going to be a walk in and it'll all be, you know, easy for her, and therefore a lot of people won't show up to vote because they won't be motivated to vote? Because I think one of the main motivations to vote for Hillary with a lot of people is that they can't abide Trump.
Well, you know, any and all scenarios are worth considering. However, I do think that the more that this stuff turns up for, you know, showing Trump to be who many of us always knew he was, even if we didn't have all the particulars, I think it increases the turnout of women who will come out to vote for Hillary. And women always comprise a larger proportion of the electorate than men. But I think that, you know, there will be Republican women, swing voter women, who will come out for Hillary just to lodge their protest against Trump. So I don't know that I would worry as much about that particular scenario of like, oh, well, she's got it in the bag because he's so bad. I think that a lot of women, maybe women who are registered to vote, but, you know, would not necessarily be inclined to go out of their way to do so on Election Day, I think the more this stuff pops up, the more inclined they'll be to turn up at the polls.
Well, what always amazes me is, particularly when I watch that first debate, because, you know, he can get by with sound bites and rallies, and they play these little clips of him making outrageous statements. But when you actually see this man on a split screen for 90 minutes, you realize the more you see, the less there is. And there's no substance there. It's obvious. There's no intellect. There's no knowledge. There's no decency. It's just a terrible kind of fraud, which is, by the way, the first Republican to come out against him was Mitt Romney. And it's worth noting that every former American president and presidential campaign, with the exception of Bob Dole, starting with George H.W. Bush, has come out against Trump now, with John McCain joining that list.
Right.
I can't see how this new debate, the one tonight, will be any different, in the sense that the more you see, the less there is. And he can fume and say outrageous things about Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton and tried his best to distract from his problems by dredging up their marital when their marriage went off the rails. And I think a lot of people's marriages in this country, by the way, have gone off the rails. So there may be some...
You think?
I think the statistics bear that out. So do you share that idea that it's just extraordinary this guy's got as far as he has? And the real issue is, how did this happen to America?
Well, yes, I do. Well, it's extraordinary. I mean, I would not have predicted it. However, as I said, you know, when we started talking, the Republican Party did cultivate the ground for a character like this to emerge. And what we're seeing is, this is not so much what has happened to America, Ann, is what Trump has done has exposed these strains of you know, of enmity and misogyny and racial fears and hatred and religious prejudice that have always existed in America. This is, you know, this is part of America. But, you know, after the Civil Rights Act was passed, it became impolite to express these things overtly. So what the Republican Party did, and especially, you know, the right-wing takeover, was they euphemized all of this. They became very adroit at creating euphemisms for various things, things that we now call dog whistles, you know, whether it was, you know, Reagan's welfare queen or whether it was states' rights, the whole ideological trappings of states' rights. You know, acceding to the state the rights to discriminate against various groups of people. The religious right itself was built out of the shards of the segregationist South. You know, this is, you know, an expression of these currents that have always existed in America. And what Trump has done is expose them to the light of day. Unfortunately, the manner in which he's done so, the way it's changing what is culturally acceptable to say, when you have even the New York Times now, you know, using, you know, in order to quote him, has to use language that was never permissible by their editorial board for use in the paper. Right. You know, that's where the damage is going to come from. That and the backlash that we're going to see should Clinton win.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Adele Stan.
It's been great to be with you again, Ian.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Adele Stan, who is the Washington editor of Alternet and a weekly columnist for The American Prospect, where she has an article decoding Mike Pence's misogyny. And at thealternet.org, she has an article, Will the Presidential Debate Add Fuel to the Trumpster Fire?
This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.
Time.